And welcome to Maintenance Phase, the podcast where sometimes we issue bonus episodes where we only kind of know what we're talking about.
Where we have no idea where the premise of the show fits into any of this.
We decided that we wanted to talk about Meghan and Harry and Oprah's interview with them, and that's what we did. And so it's a bonus episode. So congratulations.
So we're recording this little intro because, as you know, we've been doing a series of Oprah episodes on our show, and we did two episodes that were like kind of relevant to like what our show is about. But then as we were talking with Kimberly, we realized that like all three of us have like numerous thoughts on just the Meghan and Harry situation. And we were like, why don't we just like talk about that for 2 hours and record it? So we're not really going to do much of an intro. We're just going to make the doo-doo-doo sound. And then we're just going to throw you into this episode. So we're starting off with me describing the background of Meghan and Harry. And we'll just sort of see where it goes from there.
Yeah, it takes some turns, team.
It takes some turns. So thank you for supporting us.
You all are the best.
Yeah. And we're glad we're making you feel weird about cultural figures.
Excellent.
Doodle-doo.
Mike, tell me what you know about Harry and Meghan. What's their sort of origin story?
Okay, I am this show's accidental expert on the royal family. Me and Sarah did a series on Princess Diana, and then that led us, of course, to Prince Harry, who is the son of Princess Diana and Prince Charles. And I didn't really pay attention to, like, really in any way think of him at all until he started dating Meghan Markle, who is an American actress. She was on a show called Suits, which I have never seen, but people say is good. They met at some sort of charity function thing and started dating quietly. And then he announced that they were dating and the British media fucking exploded. It was like very palpable that she was being held to a completely different standard than all of the other members of the royal family. Like, she was photographed infamously eating avocado toast at one point, which is like a normal thing that human beings consume. And then The entire article was like, avocados are used to fund drug cartels in Mexico. And it was like the photo next to it was like of a guy in camo with like an AK-47.
In fairness, I'll say, as a white woman eating avocado toast in my home, when that happens, someone pops up and goes, you know you're funding drug cartels, right?
Lord. And so this is sort of what on some level gave rise to the Oprah interview, or at least that's my understanding, because the press was so terrible to her and She wasn't really able to respond. She wasn't really able to strike back because she was so controlled by the royal family, basically. So after she and Harry announced that they were like stepping back from the royal family or like retiring, like they then had the freedom to go and do a like you're wrong about style interview with Oprah where they would like clear the air. Like that was my understanding of like why they were doing this, was just like to tell the story from their side, basically.
Right. Because Oprah had asked before the wedding about doing an interview and Meghan said, I can't do that. I'm not allowed.
Right.
And
right.
Like, as you mentioned, like they step back from their roles as senior royals in January of 2020. And then there's the palace announcement that they're not coming back as working members of the British royal family. So, and you know, having lived in England a bit, I just want to point out that the viciousness of the red tops or the tabloids is unparalleled.
It's unbelievable. Yeah, it's absolutely. I also lived in Britain, and it's like it has to be seen to be believed.
And the things that they will say about race and sort of the context of the racism there is, you know, it's a completely different context because it's a context of a different kind of imperialism and colonialism.
Right.
But it's also couched in a very kind of demure Britishness.
Right. I read a bunch of old tabloid stories about Meghan for our episode that me and Sarah did. And what stood out to me, first of all, was just like the total lack of good faith that they showed her. Mm. That it was like all about like her being a social climber. And there were these stories about like, you know, her first marriage was like 10, 12 years ago or something. And there's this like expose about like how she's not friends with anybody who was in the wedding photo or something like that. And it's like, it's been 12 years. Like most people aren't friends with their friends from when they were in their early 20s, when they're in their mid 30s. Like it's not even that they're getting the facts wrong necessarily, but it's like the way that they're interpreting the facts in just like the least charitable way, it's very obviously racialized because they don't do this with other figures.
Right.
Right. So if you, like me, are thinking of like a version of the tabloids that's like, Lady Bunny said a really catty thing about who wore it best, like, just put that out of your mind because that is like extremely not what's happening with British tabloids.
And I think the idea that the paper that you read tells you something about your place in British society, I think, is very different than how we might think about being in the United States. And if you read the New York Times or the Wall Street Journal, I think that's more about like interest as opposed to who you are as a person, which is supposed to be ingrained in your identity based on class in the UK.
I love the UK. I would move back to London in a heartbeat. I loved my time there. One of the things that you notice is that everything in Britain has a class component. Like, class is just veined through every interaction. My boyfriend when I lived in Britain was British, and at one point I was sort of making toast for us and I brought him his toast, and he said that I cut the toast in a lower class way.
Wow.
I had cut it like perpendicular. Like, I'd cut it into two rectangles, the piece of bread, instead of two triangles, diagonal. And like, he wasn't doing this to be a jerk. Like, he was commenting on it like, it's funny that you don't know this and I do. But it's like, that's the extent to which like class is a part of British life. Like, it is in everything.
That's some Illuminati shit cutting. Right? I don't like it.
I was like, are you gaslighting me? Like, is this real?
You're like, right. I have been cutting toast like a poor person. Like, what?
Like a fucking plebe. This fucking plebe toast.
What I was about Greece and having lived there as a Black American was that I felt invisible. You think about the experience of going into a store in the United States as a Black person and being hyper visible and followed around. But there, you know, they're rude to everybody in the stores there. They ignore everybody.
Yeah.
But as soon as I opened my mouth and they heard I was American, I became visible. So there was a strange like overlapping of race and nation that I experienced as a dark-skinned Black woman. So I'm thinking that how they treated Meghan Markle as a light-skinned mixed-race woman who, I don't know if she has ever like claimed Black identity. So there's just, it's just a clusterfuck of like identity. Some might say intersectionality. I say clusterfuck of identity.
But it is, I mean, one thing that always really struck me about racial discussions when I lived in Britain and elsewhere in Europe is that it just like isn't a part of the discourse as much, because there's this really pervasive myth that like, we don't have a race problem.
Yeah.
It's really hard to have these discussions because like, that discourse is not available in a lot of Northern Europe.
And if they can't talk about race, they can't talk about racism.
Yeah.
So they can't talk about power differentials.
Exactly.
They can't talk about structural inequality and how it's built into the system.
And that's also, Meghan Markle is such a perfect example of this, because as soon as people point out, they're like, oh, there's like a pretty obviously racialized way that she is criticized for things that Kate Middleton, who is white, is not criticized for. And it's just like, no, of course not. Like, race has nothing to do with this. Like, it just, that critique goes over the heads of so many like newspaper editors and like so many members of the British establishment, because to them, it's just like, no, we're criticizing her because she's, you know, ambitious and promiscuous. It has nothing to do with the fact that like Black women get accused of that much more than white women. Like, that's, that just like is not in their like realm of possibility at all. In this way that you're just like, are you fucking kidding me? Like, whenever people are saying this.
Right.
Anyway, we're working through all of my issues with Britain that have sat dormant in me since 2003. I'm sorry.
But we both still go back.
I know.
Okay, so they have the interview on March 7th, 2021. And the interview, it's a Harpo production. So Oprah has control of this thing. And allegedly, CBS paid a license fee of $7 to $9 million to air it.
Okay.
It's pre-taped. It's not live. And I think they consider it to be the explosive moment of the interview, which is the conversation that Harry had with an unnamed member of his family about what Archie's skin tone would look like.
And Archie is Meghan and Harry's son, right?
Right, right. It's interesting that it's not shocking enough that it happened, but that someone needs to be ascribed with that action.
Yeah, that was interesting to me too, yeah. It was like we needed to know the specific person.
Because we need to think that the royal family isn't racist and that it's an old person who's gonna die. And racism will die with them.
Right. It's also, part of the reason that white people in particular latched onto that, or it feels like to me, is that it serves this like constant narrative that white people create and then also eat up all the time, which is like, there are good white people and bad white people, and bad white people are sort of aberrant. So we need to figure out who the person is who said this thing so that we can know who the bad white person is, and we can all go back to resting assured that we're the good kind of white person, right? Like there's sort of reassurance to a degree in that level of overt racism, because it's like one of the kinds that white people of all ages and walks of life can spot most easily, right? And
yeah,
like, that's bad. I'm not doing that, so I'm okay, right?
Yeah. And also, yeah, I mean, it's not particularly shocking that somebody in the royal family would say some like super fucked up racist shit.
Not at all.
And that they would be thinking almost exclusively of like their public persona and like how it would quote unquote look. It does seem like the overall impression out of this interview that you get is this family is like completely obsessed with their public image and also like weirdly bad at managing it.
Yeah, it also is sort of wild to me that that was the jaw dropper of a moment from that interview, because I'm like, you guys remember the blackface brooch, right?
That's exactly, yes.
This is not like breaking news. You know what I mean? Like, no, this is like, oh yeah, the thing that we've been talking about for as long as they have been together continues to be a thing.
What's the blackface brooch? Aubrey, I didn't actually know about this one.
Oh, buddy. So I'm going to recount it to the best of my recollection. It was like when they got engaged, maybe there was some kind of royal family function to celebrate their engagement. And it was one of the first big things that Meghan was at. And one of the royals wore a brooch that was like a blackface caricature.
Ooh.
It was Princess Michael of Kent. I will never forget her name.
Oh, yeah. God bless, Kimberly. No. Let me tell you dates, times, names.
Was it one of those like miserable little like Santa's little helper blackface elves that they have in the Netherlands? Like what actually was it?
It was a quote unquote blackamoor brooch.
Oh.
I just found a picture of it and I'm going to drop it if I can, if CNN will let me grab it from the website. Done.
Oh, shit.
Look at her.
This is also one of those things where I'm like, I'm sort of astonished it still exists in the world. Like outside of like a museum of racism or like a really weird thrift shop.
Of all the jewelry she has.
I know.
And as like one of the largest standing and proudest colonial institutions in the world to be like, hey, look at this jewelry of people that we subjugated. No.
Yeah, maybe wear a different offensive brooch. Maybe wear one that's offensive to like gay people or something. Oh, like a different group.
How about no brooch? Just no brooch.
Maybe just no brooches tonight.
But I wanted to just have us check out this clip.
Ooh.
I don't have a clip of from the whole interview because it has disappeared.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
So Oprah went on CBS This Morning to talk to her best friend, Gail. And I don't even know the other reporter's name because it's Oprah and Gail.
Yeah. Right.
So, but they're kind of doing like a postmortem of the interview. And Gail wants to ask Oprah some things about the interviews. I think this is, she's already called her the queen of all media. So let me drop this in the chat.
Ginnikuda. 420, blaze it.
What?
What's happening?
It's paused at 420.
Oh.
God, you guys are slow on the uptake this morning. Come on.
Because of 420 last night.
You know that classic stoner, Michael Hobbs.
I know. I got my tie-dyed sheets behind me, hair in a ponytail.
I really like that you have like it's like a 1992 caricature of a stoner in your mind. You're like, I'm Jim Brewer's character in Half Baked.
That's the last time I smoked weed. It was like 1998. All my references are fossilized.
Oh, that's so adorable.
That is really cute.
3, 2, 1, go.
Let's talk about, the jaw-dropping moment, the first one, about the color of the baby's skin. Yeah. And you asked Harry about it when he came out. He did not tell you who it was. Did you all have another conversation about it? Because that was something that there's a big guessing game all around the world. Who was it? Who was it? Who was it? And I thought it was very touching that Harry still is choosing to protect the identity of whoever that was.
Yes, and he did not share the identity with me, but he wanted to make sure that I knew, and if I had an opportunity to share it, that it was not his grandmother nor his grandfather that were a part of those conversations.
That it was not his grandmother and Prince Philip, you said?
Yeah,
was not
and his
a part.
Grandfather. Neither his grandmother nor grandfather were a part of those conversations.
Dude, Oprah seems kind of salty.
I will say it really, I was genuinely, like, I feel like I was the target audience for that clip because I was like, oh, it wasn't the old people. Like, I just absolutely assumed that the people who had spent, you know, 90 plus years in one of the world's most insulated institutions only around other white people would be like, yeah, yeah, yeah. No, this seems like a fine topic of conversation. And then I was like, no, of course, that's everyone.
Oh, how did it seem to you, Kimberly? Why did you choose that clip?
I chose it because it feels like it's just the way that CBS kept trying to market this interview. They kept using words like bombshell and explosive moments. And at this point, like you say, Oprah seems salty. I think she's just exhausted with the focus on that particular instance of racism. Because there were reactions to the video that, like, it was gripping. I haven't reacted to so that much TV since Game of Thrones, the early seasons. And people calling her a genius. And I think throughout the interview, there's a kind of knowingness to her about being the subject of that kind of scrutiny and of the tabloids that I feel like runs through the interview. She says at one point, you know, if you've ever been scrutinized like this, then you will know the viciousness of it. And so there's a kind of empathy that I think we would not allow for a journalist to have. But for Oprah, we will allow this because we have also been with her on this journey.
Right.
In her encounters with the media and her own struggles. Right. And how she had, you know, sort of early on positioned herself as every woman. But now we sort of genuflect to her like our own American royalty.
Right. I feel like these Oprah interviews have become like appealing to like John at the pearly gates or something, right? It's like she sort of transcended this idea that she's like a normal person. It just seems like so much more monumental to do these kinds of interviews with her. I also think on some level, her interviewing style is like an indictment of traditional journalism. Because one of the reasons why she's a good interviewer is because she's like empathic. And she allows herself to have these like human reactions to things where she's like, what? When they say the thing about the baby. I think people like that. I think people want those human reactions because it's easier to have a parasocial relationship with somebody who's having these human reactions to moments rather than these like fake journalism reactions.
Michael, you mentioned parasocial when we talked about Oprah the first time. Can you just define what you mean by it?
Oh yeah, this is something that comes up a lot in celebrity studies now, that the nature of celebrity has changed over the last 20 years, and there's a lot more focus on authenticity. And this is especially true with people that are sort of at the other end of the fame spectrum than Oprah, like people, you know, YouTubers or Instagram influencers or podcasters, where so much of sort of their appeal to you is that they're like a normal person. You do form like real relationships with these people, and in your head, they actually fulfill a similar function to a friendship.
So are we friends with Oprah now, or is there something else happening? Because I'm thinking of the way people deployed GIFs from this interview afterwards was pretty remarkable.
I loved it.
Oprah is like your aspirational friend. Like if everything was going awesome in your life, then your part of your reward would be you get to be friends with Oprah. Can you imagine? Can you ever imagine?
One day I will cut my toast like Oprah.
Yeah. I mean, it is interesting thinking about Oprah and parasocial relationships because she's actually one of the first major celebrities with whom we've had this relationship, partly because of her struggles with weight and also just the amount of time that she was on TV. And there was this sort of sense of like wanting to protect her and this sense of, you know, being like ecstatically happy for her when she loses weight and sad for her when she gains the weight back. She was one of the first people. I mean, if you compare her to somebody like Angelina Jolie or Julia Roberts, we don't really get very much behind the scenes content of like what is Julia Roberts thinking about her weight and her eating habits? Like we don't get a way in to those celebrities, like those traditional old style celebrities.
And I think there's an interesting combination of authenticity and authority.
Yes, yes.
I think social media is, well, theoretically supposed to be driven by authenticity, that's what appeals is people being real.
Yeah.
And so when we looked at clips from the show, we noted the ways in which she code switches and, you know, she talks a little more black when she's talking about food or her body or something like that. But I think when we move to social media, now we're just, sometimes we're down to, you know, images with memes or moving GIFs. Mm. And with Oprah, we have both that authenticity of the ways that we think we know her, mm-hmm. but also her authority.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, I think there's something also about when we're talking about sort of like, what's the public appeal of Oprah with this sort of question of like authority and authenticity and all of that kind of stuff. And it really does feel like Oprah has laid quite a bit of the groundwork for this idea of, I'm going to be totally authentic and completely strategically curated at the same time.
Yeah, yeah.
And I'm going to render that curation invisible to you.
Mm-hmm.
You're just going to see what I decide to produce and how I decide to produce it from my own studio,
right.
with my own self, with me in control of sort of all of it, right?
Mm-hmm,
which is super duper smart and also creates this weird sort of parallel universe where folks seem to really think that she is sort of bearing all at all times,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
right? And not really reckoning with the ways in which, like, no, that would be a really bad business decision for a lady who is all about business.
Right. I mean, that's also the thing with parasocial relationships is that it makes you forget that it's performed.
Mm-hmm.
It's a version of somebody. I don't think that people are really fake, but because, you know, you're seeing them sort of without their makeup on, or, you know, you're seeing them struggle with their weight and they're talking about things that people really didn't talk about publicly, because you're seeing that, you think like, oh, they're telling me everything.
Look, what Mike's trying to say is that off mic, he and I are both monsters.
Yeah. We're barely speaking.
That is what I have learned by being a fan and now being on the podcast.
We're recording all of these separately because we can't be in the same room with each other.
So, yeah, I think, you know, of the key moments that happened during the interview and the quote-unquote bombshell moments, definitely when Oprah starts to discuss with Meghan how she was feeling suicidal.
Mm-hmm.
I think she's trying to get into, like, what was Harry's reaction to Meghan's feeling suicidal? He just seems so awkward the entire time. And of course you're going to be, like, these are painful topics. So of course you're going to feel hesitant. But not only does he not have the language to talk about racism, but he's slowly getting to the language for talking about mental health issues.
Right. But also, he's a British upper class person. This is not a culture, in my experience in Britain, that is like super comfortable with like tough topics. I think it was an interesting moment because it's like his European nobility social norms side coming out, where like so much of the social mores of upper crust British life are about like not talking about difficult things, and that they find that really uncomfortable. Did you find this in Britain? I found this like super palpable when I lived in Britain. I had trouble sort of forming like more intimate relationships with people, or like going beyond surface level stuff unless we were drinking.
Mm.
And it was like only after two or three beers that people would be like, yeah, things are bad with my girlfriend. I'm really struggling at this new job, or like whatever it was that would sort of build intimacy. We could only do it in like very prescribed circumstances.
Someone once claimed to me that British people were very, well, the English, let me correct that. Mm-hmm. Someone said that the English are really hard to get to know. Like, they're not going to take you in immediately, but once you're in, you're in.
Mm-hmm.
And I was thinking about how does that work with somebody like the royals, where getting in is super hard.
Right. Getting in involves an NDA.
Yes.
Right.
And like some insane, like up, up, down, down, left, right, BA start, like code. For all of the fucking curtsying and handshaking and greeting people. I mean, one thing that I found actually so interesting from the interview is there's all this weird protocol, but like they take it seriously even in private.
Huh.
It's not just like, oh, when the cameras are rolling, you have to curtsy to me and there's this protocol. It's like, no, when you meet my grandmother, you have to curtsy and you have to greet her in like this specific order and say these specific things. It's like, really? Like these people don't understand how fake all this stuff is.
Right. I thought that Meghan tried to reveal that by consistently calling the royal family the firm.
Oh.
And I was kind of amazed that Oprah let her keep doing that.
Mm.
Like every time she said it, I was like, huh.
That is a bold choice.
Yeah. Like they, Oprah and Harry might talk about the family, but she kept calling it the firm and reinforcing for us, the viewers, or at least for me, that this is a business.
Yeah.
And it has protocols and it has power.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It was weird throughout the interview how she kept calling the entire royal family bitch-ass crown jockeys. I noticed that too. It was a subtle way of reminding them. But also, yeah, I mean, I also thought the Suicide Alley stuff was really interesting simply because it's like, you know, this is somebody with a lot of privilege. This is somebody who's obviously wealthy. What matters is how isolated you are within your own community oftentimes. And so all of this sort of adulation or popularity among the populace at large, like that doesn't really get in. Like she's not feeling how admired she is among the population. All she's feeling is like totally gaslit and isolated by the royal family itself.
Yeah, I'm actually just looking up the Piers Morgan response because I do feel like that Piers Morgan response is much more likely to reach her than this sort of sense of like, you did it.
Fucking Piers Morgan, dude.
Right?
Oh my fucking God.
Oh God.
There are so many bad. I searched for Piers Morgan, Meghan Markle. And the number of times that that dude has, like, I'm having a hard time finding the stuff about suicidality because he has said so many horrible things about her. He's just like a one-man factory. Oh, he's upset that Oprah Winfrey didn't challenge Meghan's claims.
Oh, yeah.
Like, it's just such a bizarre thing to be like, this lady said she was suicidal and nobody helped her, but nobody asked if that was real.
Yeah. It's like that thing where it's like she's making up that she was sexually assaulted to get famous or whatever. And it's like things do not work out that great for women who say that they were sexually assaulted, especially by like a famous and well-liked man.
Yeah.
So the idea that she's like faking that she was suicidal, it's like the world is not nice to women who talk about mental health struggles.
Racially, the subtext is this manipulation that she's doing.
That's right. It's a little bit of like a Yoko vibe, right?
Yeah.
That she's like breaking up the royal family. They were doing some of their best work and she broke them up.
Also like the same thing with Yoko. It's like this weird sense of ownership. The royal family belongs to me, or John Lennon belongs to me. And here comes this, you know, woman of color usurper who's like breaking it up and taking it away from me somehow. It's this very like toddler with a toy kind of response.
Mm.
There's a good Daily Mail column with, I mean, not good, but there's a telling Daily Mail column where Piers Morgan is talking about how it's disgraceful. It's a disgraceful smear to call his attacks on Meghan Markle racist.
He's so thin-skinned.
I know.
It feels like Play School's My First Reverse Racism kit or something. Do you know what I mean? We're like, oh, that's cute. You got like the Duplo blocks and like the big ones that are easier.
Yeah.
Okay, there's polling around public sympathy for Meghan, and it's real rough.
Wait, really?
So this was a poll conducted on March 8th, 2021 by YouGov. The question was, from what you've read and heard, how much sympathy, if any, do you have for Harry and Meghan? 12% of people said a lot, 17% said a fair amount, 23% said not very much, and 33% said none at all.
Whoa.
Wow.
Yeah.
That reads like pure race to me, honestly, because Princess Diana, who went through basically word for word exactly the same thing as Meghan Markle, she got way more sympathy among the public, like way more. It's almost like a controlled experiment of like run the exact same thing with a black lady and a white lady. And like, who do people feel bad for? That's incredible.
Yeah, for sure. So following the airing of the interview in the UK on March 8th, so the day after, Piers Morgan is one of the co-hosts of Good Morning Britain. He goes on the show and is sort of talking about this interview. And he says about Meghan Markle and particularly about her claims of suicidality, he says, quote, I don't believe a word she says. I wouldn't believe her if she read me a weather report.
Christ.
It does feel like when we sort of get into these conversations about cancellation, quote unquote, which is what Piers Morgan seems to want to sort of steer us toward, it's easy to lose sort of the initial inciting incident. And that is a monstrous thing to say to and about a person who has confided, like, a massively stigmatized mental health issue on international television.
Yeah.
What happens next is essentially he is asked to apologize and says if he doesn't apologize, he should leave the show. And he leaves the show and says, I won't apologize for something I believe. It's astounding to say it, first of all, and then second of all, to be given the opportunity to walk it back and go, no, I'm going to double down.
And as usual, he cast this as like, I was fired for my speech. Like, this says bad things about free speech. And it's like, no, people say bad things all the time. You were fired for not apologizing and not acknowledging that it was bad. Like, there's actually a huge difference between those things.
And not grappling with, what does this mean for the fallout sort of how we treat Black women in media? What does it mean for the fallout in terms of how we discuss mental health in media?
Yeah.
It's just like, no, I said it and I meant it. Now you're all bullying me or something, right? Where you're like, that's not what any of those words mean. Like, I don't know what to tell you.
Also, I have like a binder full of Piers Morgan being trash because me and Sarah did an episode on it. So do you guys want me to read some of the headlines of articles that he's written for the Daily Mail over the years?
I don't, and I absolutely do.
It's so bad.
I'm not ready, and I'm ready.
This is his words, right? So, Meghan Markle is a ruthless social climbing actress who has landed the role of her life and is determined to milk it for all she can, and that's why the palace is beginning to turn on her.
Sorry, that is like some Anna Nicole Smith bullshit.
I mean, social climbing? Like, what does that even mean?
Right.
That's something only women get accused of.
You know how he knows that she's a social climber?
Mm-hmm.
She started cutting her toast diagonally. And he's like, aha!
There's here's another one from 2020. Meghan and Harry's new book only confirms that they're the world's most tone-deaf, hypocritical, narcissistic, deluded, whiny brats.
Wow.
January 2020. Meghan and Harry haven't been criticized because of her color, but because she's a selfish social climber and he's a weak whiner. And by playing this despicable race card, they have grossly libeled all of Britain.
Wow. We're back to the Duplo blocks. The play school is my first, where I'm like, oh, race card.
I know.
That's cute.
I also think it's so telling that, you know, we find out, I mean, he's been relatively open about this to his credit, but also to his not credit, all of his animosity toward Meghan Markle appears to be based on the fact that he went on what he considered a date with her once.
Ew.
And she sort of excused herself. She was like, oh, I got to go to this other thing. And then at this event, after they had hung out, is kind of when she meets Harry, apparently. So he has built up this absurd narrative in his head that if she hadn't met Harry that night, she would have gotten with him.
Oh, Jesus.
And that Harry sort of like owes him some sort of gratitude. So he's actually talked about how like, oh, like I have nothing against Prince Harry, but you know, he ruined my friendship with Meghan Markle.
So who's the social climber? Who?
Exactly.
Yeah, that's right. I was going to be friends with her and then she had to go and become a princess.
It's like you hung out once. It's like so weird to build like this glorious friendship on like a couple Twitter DMs. And you got a beer fucking once.
But it seems like none of those headlines are the things that eventually get him taken off the air.
Right.
And I mean, at least like to its credit, I'm surprised that he actually was taken off the air, even asked to apologize. And I think the weight of the Ofcom complaints, which I always find to be like a fascinating aspect of British culture, that people, if they see something on TV or in radio that they don't like, they will call Ofcom and lodge thousands of complaints. And most of those seem to be, in this instance, about disrespecting the issue of her mental health and not about race.
Right.
So he's kind of gingerly trying to throw a race card in there every once in a while. But really, it's a very sort of gendered attack on her.
Yeah. Should we watch the clip, y'all?
Ooh,
oh, God.
I just found it. Okay, this clip is 14 minutes long.
Jesus Christ.
So we obviously are not going to watch the entire 14 minutes, but like, let's see how far we get and decide if we want to like skip forward and it gets boring.
Okay.
Yeah. Sounds good.
I've walked into institutions as the only person of color and experienced covert and overt racism on so many occasions. And why the Meghan interview really resonates with me is because an ex-work colleague asked me if I was worried about the shade of cocoa that my son was going to come out.
Right.
When you are a lighter shade of black, people gain confidence and feel that they can say things to you that they wouldn't say to a black person. And
by the way, I completely respect that, right? And that's why I wanted to get you on the program today. It was my suggestion to have you on to talk about this.
But Piers, and thank you so much for having me on the program. I really appreciate it. But I just want you also to be aware of the power of your words. And I'm not saying that you're a racist, but what I
What are you saying?
Do you know what I honestly feel? Because of your previous relationship with Meghan Markle, you've sometimes...
I didn't have a relationship with Meghan Markle.
You met up with her, you knew her.
I knew her briefly. Right,
so we've joked about it on the show.
I'm allowed to speak.
Okay, talk.
All that did was inform me that she's a bit of a cut and run.
Right.
Right, throughout her life, and all her family, her father... Yes. Her ex-husband, her ex-friend, right. They've all been cut out of her life, right? And it's an interesting observation that I happen to be one of those people.
An interesting observation,
Can I finish
this situation
sentence,
that you are struggling
guys, guys, if we're going to have this conversation...
You've got to let me talk.
I'll talk.
She has now got the whole of America and the worst of the world, frankly, looking upon the palace, the monarchy, as a bunch of racists. And my question for you is this, and it's a straight question I think a lot of people are asking. Is there a qualitative difference between somebody perhaps innocently saying to you, mm-hmm. out of interest, if you have one parent is white, one parent is black, you know, what colour could your baby be? Let me finish. What colour could your baby be? Is there a difference between that question phrased in that innocent, perhaps, mm-hmm. way and somebody doing it in a tone that says, well, how dark is your baby going to be?
Well,
in a derogatory, racist
tone. Right, exactly, and there is a difference. But what we're getting from the interview is that it was said in a negative way.
She said that, but he didn't, did he?
Lot to unpack.
Holy fucking shit. Before we get into the unpacking, I am noticing in myself while I'm watching this clip a visceral response to just the way that Piers Morgan speaks and carries himself. That is a similar kind of response that I have when I'm like in a bar and there's a dude who you're like, I think that dude might haul off and hit somebody.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
It really struck me watching this clip that I was like, I hate it.
It reminds me of all the bad bosses I've ever had. It's like very bad boss energy. Like, yes. Mm-hmm. Anyway, yes. I agree with what you're saying. Yes. Anyway, I'm going to say something totally unrelated now.
Because I'm not listening at all.
Yeah.
Also, you just said a smart thing and I'm going to take credit for it by saying it was my idea to have you on the show. Like, bold.
I'm kind of speechless because I was watching his face and it's just clear he's not listening.
Oh yeah.
I just don't understand. Like, I do understand actually. His agenda is to appear to be supporting the royals because he can speak to a particular kind of white supremacy and disaffection in UK culture. Mm. And so it doesn't actually matter who Meghan is or that Oprah did the interview. It always sort of comes back to, like, how is he going to appear to be the champion of the culture?
Right.
When Alex Beresford is talking, I am struck with... How am I trying to say this? What am I trying to say?
Would you like me to interrupt you constantly and then say, let me finish? Would that help?
Let me speak.
Butt in.
I'm struck by Alex Beresford attempting to align his experience and Meghan's experience of being mixed race, but they're in different national contexts.
Right.
And there's a Black British history that has gained a lot more traction now, but at that time, I think went unacknowledged. So I think that Black and mixed race Britons are now speaking from even like an even greater position of authority, mm-hmm. in terms of recognizing the role of their parents and grandparents after World War II,
right.
in rebuilding Britain. And even in, you know, the places where in the Commonwealths, where they still actually, like Queen Elizabeth is still their queen, they have a different claim to citizenship that I think is in some ways more powerful, but yet untapped. And I think that's where the struggle is in trying to talk to white British people about their racism.
And also the racism among existing institutions, that I find it so interesting that Piers Morgan like cannot compute the sort of like the actual case against the British royal family. That first of all, I don't think anybody is saying that like this one comment means that the entire British royal family like is racist to their core. Mm-hmm. Most of the people that are actually making the case that like the British royal family is racist is talking about like colonialism and like the decades of subjugation of other countries. But of course, Piers Morgan is like incapable of sort of absorbing that entire critique or showing any curiosity about like, well, what is actually like the case that the British royal family is racist? Like, I'm going to actually look into this. He's trying to boil it down to like the weakest possible claim, right? He's like, you're saying the British royal family is racist just because somebody made this one comment.
It feels like there's a through line between sort of Piers's response to all of this with sort of the way that a lot of cis men, cis straight men respond to allegations of sexual assault, which is like, this is a very serious allegation and we need to investigate it thoroughly before making these kinds of big claims,
right?
And sort of trying to paint the other person as irresponsible rather than listening for, like, what is this person actually trying to tell me? It is a willfully obtuse kind of reading of it.
Another parallel to the sexual assault thing is that oftentimes when men are accused of this, they'll try to boil it down to like one instance. They'll be like, oh, I asked her out for a drink after work, and the next thing you know, I was hearing from her lawyer.
Making it seem
like this one honest mistake is being blown up into this like accusation of something really horrible. But then, of course, they leave out all the context that it's like, oh, it's actually the 18th time that you asked her out. And like when you asked her out, you were outside of her bedroom window masturbating. Like, right. They're leaving out all of this extra context.
And I would say there is this sort of false binary that's being proposed, which is like there are intentional racist acts and then there are innocent acts that are sort of based in curiosity that are not racist. And what I would say to that is racist impacts do not require your good or bad intentions, right? Like, you can be genuinely curious about something about someone else related to their race, and that curiosity can be rooted in a racist sense of entitlement to know things about them.
It's disguised as like, I just want to make connection.
Right.
There are so many other ways and like bases on which to make connection with another person aside from trying to delineate difference.
Right.
Which is what those ways of asking those kinds of questions always turn out to be about, like, right. difference in power.
Right, right. I just wanted to make a connection with you by asking how dark-skinned your baby is going to be. Like, what?
Where are you from? What do you do? How dark is your baby?
What shade is your baby?
Yeah. How's the weather there? And also, let me get out this brown paper bag.
So this clip, I mean, everyone sort of knows this by now, but this clip culminates in Piers Morgan storming off.
Throwing his toys out of the pram, as the British would say.
Into the lorry, and then the boot. Yeah. So this is the essay question for you, Kimberly. What do you think the interview says about Oprah? We should end with Oprah thoughts.
Yeah, there we go.
We should end everything with Oprah thoughts.
I mean,
remember your spirit.
The question I keep coming back to lately with thinking about Oprah is, what does Oprah need? Because we assume she has everything in terms of the material things and the power. Mm-hmm. And I don't think she needed anything in particular from this interview. And this may be my own ideas about parasociality. But, you know, she was doing her friend a solid. And I wonder how much of doing this interview was Oprah's own experience with being a Black woman, having lies told about her by the press, and wanting to offer a space for Meghan Markle to stick up for herself, all the while this being a very lucrative way to do it.
Yeah. You can do a little you're wrong about a maligned woman, and you can make tens of millions of dollars in the process.
Yeah.
Thinking about the reactions to Oprah, it was interesting that there were critiques that she didn't go hard enough at them.
Mm.
And it seems like a lot of that then becomes about her being friends with them.
It is funny because it genuinely is like pretty unethical to just interview your friends like as a journalist. She really doesn't get that much criticism for this kind of thing, which is interesting.
I think she occupies an interesting place where news becomes infotainment.
Mm.
I think our local news markets become diluted and there's media consolidation. And I think there's less local news so that our news starts to also report on the entertainment industry as if it's hard-hitting news. And I think Oprah was there at the right time for that.
Yeah.
I think part of the anticipation of this interview was like, if anybody can get to what's going on here, it's Oprah. Like, I don't think that this interview would have gotten the same response if it was Diane Sawyer or if it was
Joe Rogan.
Yeah. Jesus. If it was Elon Musk and Joe Rogan smoking weed on the Joe Rogan.
Smoking blunts. talking about how vaccines are fake.
Harry might have been more lucid.
Oprah, like, buy my keto powder, bro.
Yeah, so that is part of what is, I really feel left with in this, is that the interview, the focus of the interview was Meghan and Harry. There was this sort of like internet response that was the use of Oprah's reactions.
Yeah.
But there wasn't really criticism of Oprah in that interview as part of the fallout. There wasn't really critique of her role in it writ large that I tracked. Did you all track anything?
It is actually weird to me that, like, Piers Morgan, like, there's another black woman in there that you can attack, Piers. Like, that's clearly... It's weird that he skipped right over the other minority he could blame for stuff that they didn't do.
Right.
Interesting choice, Pierce.
So that feels like what I'm left with here is just like, this is such a marker of sort of the level that Oprah has sort of ascended to in American culture. Yeah. How about you? What are you left with, Mike?
I was going to, all I'm going to do is repeat your stuff because your stuff is insightful. I have nothing. Nothing.
Ditto.
All I can do is like rephrase what you said. Aubrey's right.
So in the what have we learned today category, if we're going to wrap it all up, I think if Piers Morgan has anything to say, don't listen.
Yes.
That's my what have we learned today. Just don't listen to that guy.
Yeah, because he's a big fucking social climber. Never trust men who climb socials.